What's the 411? 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. This hour, we're going to tap into the pulse of today's youth. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and joining me, I am talking with Susan Pinker. Susan is a developmental psychologist and a journalist. Pinker is the author of The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. Susan, welcome to 411 Teen.
Well, thank you so much for including me on your show.
Well, I think you have some very, very valuable information you can share. You know, today's youthful generation, they've grown up on the computer. What, they're like about 23 million teens use the internet. They're all plugged in to social network and Facebook and Twitter and gaming and virtual worlds and mobile technologies. Personal contact has decreased. What was your impetus for writing The Village Effect?
Well, Liz, at the end of my last book, which I wrote about sex differences, actually, about the difference between girls and boys and men and women in both the classroom and the workplace, I was left with a puzzle. Why do women all over the world live 5 to 7 years longer than men? Why do women have longer lifespans? And a clue I discovered has to do with the power of their social bonds. The women, and in that I include teenage girls and younger girls, tend to prioritize their relationships. And what I didn't know before, and I think what most people don't know, is this leads to longer, healthier lives and the ability to stave off infection and even dementia as they age. But not all social contact is created equal. While I was researching this book, I traveled to a few faraway villages in Sardinia that are the only places in the world where men live as long as women do, and there are about 10 times as many centenarians as there are there as there are here, and the reason I discovered has to do with their social lives. They were never left alone, and by the way, the teenagers were right into the act. I mean, every centenarian I met was surrounded by a whole range of family and neighbors and, you know, the clergyman and the grocer and the teenage great-grandchildren and great-nieces were there and just there to chat and hang around and keep them company. And on a statistical basis, because, you know, that's just one story of one place, I found there were about 160 studies that follow people over time that tell us that those people who have various types of social contact in person, face-to-face, increase their odds of survival, not just by a little, but by 91%. So that's the kind of social contact that we need to survive and thrive, and that's what I'm calling in this book, The Village Effect.
Okay. Well, and I think that it just illustrates and supports what we as psychologists have known. We've been studying it. We know that social interaction, direct social interaction, has a positive impact on our lives. Those who are physically sick, those who are mentally ill, those who are coping with all types of trauma, they do it better when they have a support system. They do it better when they have individuals around them. That's basically what you're saying, right?
It's partially what I'm saying, but there's something else there that I think most people don't know. I certainly didn't, which is it's not just your nearest and dearest who matter.
Oh, no. Yeah.
It's the larger village or the larger community of people that you just run into day to day. So, you know, we used to be much more social as we went about working and going to school or just shopping in the neighborhood. We would meet people. We would run into people. We would chat. We would talk to our neighbors. And a lot of this has disappeared from our lives because either we're hopping in our cars and commuting to work and putting in a long day and then coming home and having to deal with all our chores and so on.
Shopping on the internet.
Or as kids, you know, the kids have screens everywhere and some of them are even being encouraged to go to school exclusively online.
And
so these are some of the kind of forces that I'm looking at, because quite frankly, Liz, the digital devices, online networks, they're great for sharing information, but they're not great for deepening human connections or solving human problems or building trust. And well, if we know one thing about teenagers, it's that their peer group rules. Their peer group is the most important thing to them. So it's very important for us to separate the difference between what happens online and what happens offline.
Why does face-to-face contact matter? For our listening audience, would you just share why you think it matters, what difference it makes?
Well, in a very basic way, Liz, it's a biological function, like, you know, drinking or eating or sleeping. We all need it. It's an appetite that we all have. And not only that, it releases physiological effects in our bodies when we connect with people in person. You know, when you're with somebody and you're looking in their eyes and you might, you know, give their arm a little pat, or there might be a high five or a fist bump, all those little actions produce oxytocin in the bloodstream. And the oxytocin and other hormones like it, they tamp down your stress, they reduce your stress, they kill pain, they increase your resilience. It's almost like, they call it the cuddle chemical, but it's almost, in my view, like a homegrown miracle drug, because it helps you feel good in the here and now, and it builds your immunity and your resilience into the future. Same. And when we just kind of confuse online connection with real face-to-face connection, we're missing out on that surge of oxytocin you get when you really connect with somebody. I mean, just for example, while I was writing this book, I was so overwhelmed by the new research that I was learning, it changed my own habits. And I would, you know, if I was writing in my home office and I saw my neighbor come out, I would, like, rush out the door to find out what's new in her life and chat with her, because she doesn't come out that much. It's that powerful that I know it would make me feel different and would make her feel different. And behind those good feelings are biochemical reactions that are happening sort of below our radar.
Right.
So, in other words, what impact does this face-to-face contact have on development?
Well, if we're going to just leave adults out for a minute, but children and children's brains are built for social interaction. And everything that children do at the beginning, and teenagers, is really has to do with interacting with other people, whether it's producing words or imitating behaviors they see in other, you know, other people. There is no such thing as learning language or learning empathy or learning cooperation without being face-to-face with people. And that's why we know, for example, that when you chat with your children over at the table, over mealtime, there's nothing better than that in terms of predicting school success. Almost everything about who to trust, where to get emotional support, how to solve problems is communicated not only face-to-face but non-verbally, stuff that doesn't happen through a text or an email. And especially if we're talking about, say, very young children, skin-to-skin contact is critical. It's a stimulant for growth. It's a painkiller. So it's not a question that you can just, like, prop your baby up with a bottle and go off and do your thing.
Right.
What babies really need is for us to interact with them, look them in the eye, and have that back and forth with them. But with older kids, say preschool kids, right now preschool kids are in front of a screen an average of 4 hours a day. And the majority of three-year-olds have a TV in their room right now in the United States.
That's
and
just
school
incredible.
Children are spending an average of 7 hours a day in front of a screen, more than they spend on any other activity except sleeping. And what I find, I guess, interesting but a little bit disturbing is that this is mostly time spent alone. So we know from studies coming out of the University of Washington that the more screen time, just even if the screen is on in the room, the less speech is directed to that child, and the lower his or her vocabulary. In fact, for every hour of media screen entertainment, there's 500 to 1,000 fewer adult words directed to a child or a teenager. So it's sort of just, it's displacing the interaction that kids and teenagers need to thrive.
So that's it. And you're talking about our survival. And what I hear you saying is that survival is dependent upon that face-to-face interaction, personal interaction.
Yeah, and here's the thing, is that, of course, all teenagers pretty much have smartphones now.
Yeah,
but
they do.
The more time they spend online or through any of their devices, the less socially engaged they are and the lonelier they feel. So now about two-thirds of teens text their people much more, three times as often as they call them on the phone or see them in person. I mean, we call them smartphones, but very few people actually use them to talk on the phone right now.
Right.
But here's the interesting thing, is that even parents are communicating with their teenagers this way now.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, let's say your kid is going through a hard day, or they've had an exam, or they've had a big disappointment. And many of us now might be tempted to send them a text saying, you know, I'm thinking of you, honey, and I love you, and I'm with you all the way. But the research is telling us that an emotionally supportive text has no impact at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we have time to talk about that study a little bit, Liz.
Sure, sure. Go right ahead. We've got the time. I might have to take a break, but we can certainly explore it.
Well, it's a very simple study where they tried to induce stress in kids, school-aged kids, between the ages of 9 and 12. And the way they did that is by giving them math and word problems to solve within a time limit in front of an audience. That would stress anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And they divided those kids into four groups. One group got a visit from mom after their stressful test. One group got a call from mom after their test. One group got a text, an encouraging text from mom after their test, and one group got nothing at all. And they measured how stressed out these kids were by having them spit in a cup, because they could measure their stress levels by way of measuring the cortisol levels in their saliva. And what they discovered is that when they measured the saliva before and after the test, the kids who got the visit from mom had their cortisol levels drop way down. They were face-to-face, in person, with their moms. The kids who got a call from mom, their cortisol decreased, not as much as it did face-to-face, but it still went down from the test. The ones who got a text from mom, their cortisol levels had no difference. There was no difference between their cortisol levels and the kids who got nothing from contact.
Hold your thoughts, Susan. We're going to take a brief break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We'll get back to you in 60 seconds. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. This hour, 411 Teen explores the impact of human contact. I am talking with Susan Pinker, developmental psychologist, exploring the significance of face-to-face contact. Susan, I had to interrupt you. You were talking about the results of the study. Would you like to continue, please? I think you still needed to talk to about those who had no contact at all.
Yes, I was just summarizing the findings that were completely new, and I think none of your listeners have ever heard this before, that when we have found out that texting has no impact on your teen or child's stress levels as doing nothing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And as a parent, I certainly didn't know that, and I'm sure your listeners didn't know that. And these are just some of the surprising facts that I kind of reveal in the book, but not just through research, but through people's stories that touched me, because essentially I'm interested in telling people's stories and why they do the things they do and the impact on their health and how well they do in school, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I use real people who I really know to tell the research story.
Well, you're talking about the real need, the demand. It's innate for us to interact face-to-face with other humans. Yet, we seem to be on a trajectory that has us moving away from human contact. How do we reverse this trajectory? Everything, you know, we can shop online, we can do so many things that really we don't have to interact with people. Just got finished talking about texting, even though we're finding that texting really does not have the impact that we may think it is. How do we reverse this trajectory?
I think it's not as hard as people think, actually, because if you think about using your computer for exchanging information, but using face-to-face contact for deep human connection, for improving your mood, for boosting your learning, you'll kind of separate the two. So some of the tips that I add in the book, and I'm not sure we have time to go into all of them, but some of them have to do with looking at your work and school lives and even your neighborhood in a new way. Let's say you're moving and you want to find a new place to live. It's more important to focus on whether people talk to each other, whether the neighbors know each other, than it is to find, like, big closets or parking areas. I think it's extremely important in education to focus much more on what's going on in the classroom as opposed to the classroom technology. I think a lot of parents have had the wool pulled over their eyes about classroom technology. There is no evidence that this improved your child's learning. None. In fact, 1 year with a fabulous teacher in middle school has huge impact on a child's future, but there is no laptop or tablet program so far that can compete with 1 year with a highly trained teacher. So I'm concerned, for example, about using technology as a way to increase class sizes. So I think the one thing parents should do is look for classrooms where there's real contact between parent and child, and to continue that at home with enforcing family meals with no screens at the table, so that we don't have the situation you described at the beginning of the show, Liz, where people are at Starbucks and really interacting with their phones instead of each other.
Well, you know,
I see these devices very much like junk food. They give you a quick hit of calories. They're extremely rewarding in the immediate, within seconds, but the long-lasting benefits just aren't there. And so they're nice once in a while. Nice to have a candy bar or a bag of barbecue chips once in a while.
Right.
But are you going to let your child or teenager have a steady diet?
That's the question.
Of that kind of food? Doubtful. And the very easy kind of things that you can look at as changing would be structuring face-to-face time into your day, which means, for example, family meals. If your child is on the computer, for sure, young children should not have any TVs or computers in their room that are not being monitored by parents, and only ramp up contact with screens as they get older. Certainly, as I said, no digital program yet has proven as effective as time with a trained teacher or family meals. Something else that's really important is to really focus on creating a village of diverse relationships. So if we're talking about teens, make sure that they are involved in some sort of team or group activity or civic activity that expands their face-to-face social set. So they're not just spending hours on their screen or with the same people. You know, one of the most important things I learned that was completely new is that you have to be a joiner. You have to either, and it could be almost anything. It could be a group at church. It could be having a weekly card game with your buddies. It could be joining a sports team.
Yeah, whatever.
Doing volunteer work, but it has to involve actually being with new people who you wouldn't ordinarily meet on a regular basis, and that helps to build your village, you know. Sardinia. And a lot of young people said to me, where is this place? I want to go there. And I said, you know, you don't actually want to live in a tiny little agricultural village in the middle of nowhere. You can build your village right where you are.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say, because you also emphasized that the social contact that is so important is at the beginning of life. This social contact that we have at the beginning of life helps us to cope with stress later. And I wanted to ask you to elaborate on that for the listening audience.
Sure. You know, the interesting piece of the puzzle of social contact is that when you hold your baby or hold your child or mm-hmm. interact with them face-to-face, it changes the environment around their cells and genes and sends a message about how well they're going to deal with stress in the future. So you may just do it because it feels good right now, in the here and now, but actually it's almost like a vaccine that helps to protect your child going forward. And so that's something I talk about in the book in terms of little things that, you know, small decisions like how much time you cuddle or, you know, hold your child in your lap or sing to them. All these things matter far into the future. Mm-hmm. And it's very important, for example, for kids to learn early from your own behavior that the screen and the real thing are not interchangeable. Because let's face it, it's not just teenagers who've got their heads buried in their phones. It's parents.
That's right. Well, like you were saying, by the age of 3, I think you said, a third of the American children have a TV in their bedroom. And that American children spend on an average 7 hours a day facing a screen. That's more than they engage in any other activity, okay? What's happening? These are all very convenient and easy.
Yes, and I'd like to seize on that word that you use, convenient and easy, because let's talk about what happens when you're actually communicating with somebody face-to-face. Mm-hmm. You're looking in their eyes, and you're looking at their body language. It may pass kind of below your consciousness, but all this helps you understand,
right.
Is this person trustworthy? Is this person somebody I want to be with? Is this person telling the truth? But that's not the kind of thing that you can learn about people online.
Right.
And not just that, but what is happening, and certainly not just with teenagers, with adults as well, is that sometimes relationships can be bumpy. There can be conflicts, or people's feelings can be hurt. And if you communicate only online, you get no experience.
Yeah, indeed.
With how to deal with conflict, or how to deal with people's feelings, how to give information
right.
in a sensitive way, or how to be empathic or empathetic with somebody.
Just even that nonverbal communication.
Exactly.
And that's real important. I mean, sometimes.
Well, yes. In the book, there's something I call honest signals.
Mm-hmm.
Honest signals are transmitted without language.
Right.
And they have to do with your body language, the way your voice sounds, the mm-hmm. way you mimic the other person when you talk to them, whether you kind of give each other little pats and high fives. And we know now that, for example, the more of that kind of contact within a sports team, the more goals they score. The more of that kind of contact in a working team, say in a call center, they're much more productive. We know that, for example, when you separate, you know, working teams and you make some go on staggered breaks and you allow some teams to go on break together so they can just chat and socialize, those teams that are allowed to socialize are 20% mm-hmm. more effective and productive afterwards. So there are real concrete benefits to really real contact. So when we get back to our tips, Liz, I think none of us are going to throw away our devices.
No.
These are part of our lives now. But it's a question of amplifying your online contact with real contact. Use your technology to research and arrange real get-togethers. And here's something that I think nobody is all that aware of. I never knew before I wrote this book that your relationships decay without real contact.
Mm-hmm.
So in as little as 18 months to a few years, if you haven't seen that person face-to-face, you've disappeared in their social circle, and they've disappeared in yours.
Well, what about just the change and family lifestyle patterns? I mean, parents are working, so you may have a parent that's working two jobs, they're busy, and they use this computer, the smartphone, as a babysitter. How do they get out of that pattern? You have tips for what they can do.
Right. Well, in some cases, there is just no choice, right? If that's the only way that they can keep up the communication with their child, I would certainly say using it as a phone as opposed to texting is much more effective. And you can get a feeling for how your child is doing better from phone or Skype than you can from texting.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you've put your finger on a very sensitive issue, Liz, which is that working people are very busy, and there are a lot of demands on them. And part of the reason why, for example, when you introduce network technology into some communities that are financially stressed, instead of making the kids' grades go up, kids' grades
exactly.
go down.
Yes.
And I think one of the reasons for that is that if parents are working two jobs just to keep their heads above water, there's nobody at home to make sure that your child that exactly. child is not, you know, surfing the net for movies instead of doing their book report.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
So in some ways there has to be a conversation about it at home. The way you have conversations about other things. Does your family have a conversation about other ideas like, you know, who earns the spending money?
Right.
Or what kind of food is your child eating when they come home for a snack? You know, all those conversations, every time you are sitting down with your child and having an open discussion and conversation, you're that much closer not only to coming to a solution, but just to enriching your relationship with that child. So it's not that there's a magic bullet, really,
right.
for overworked, stressed parents, but I think it's a conversation that we have to have.
Well, for teens, as we talk about texting, communicating via text or email could be much easier and safer. Would you agree? You know,
easier and safer for teenagers?
For teenagers.
I'm not sure that they see it that way.
I mean,
pardon me?
I said they may perceive it in that way, that it's easier, it's safer, they don't have to worry about, you know, how they look, they don't have to worry about how they say things, intonations and all of that. No, they don't have to worry about being misread.
Right, Ryan, yeah. I see what you mean.
Yes.
You mean the teenagers see it as easier and safer because they don't have to read the emotions on
right,
their face.
Exactly.
Right, and it is a lot easier. It's an easy way out, but the flip side of that is that you can be very misunderstood because all those clues are missing, the emotional clues are missing. And the other little piece of this discussion is that kids who are excluded or bullied or left out at school, when they get home, it just keeps on going, and there's no escape for them. And this is a very dangerous situation. So,
yes.
You know, interestingly, if teenagers feel alienated, then their attempts to form relationships on the internet just make that feeling worse. It amplifies that alienation, making them feel more depressed and lonely than they were before.
Well, why do you think this mode of communication is so popular among teens? They love to text. They text more than they go.
Well, it's popular among everybody. I think it's popular, you know, interestingly, there's a lot of loneliness in America, and it's a taboo to talk about it. But there's been a huge increase in loneliness just in the last 40 years, you know, since the mid-80s. You know, 35, 40 years, there's been a huge ramping up of loneliness. And the most lonely group is the middle-aged. So not so much the teenagers, but the parents of teenagers who are the loneliest. And so it's important to think about why are people lonely? Why are people saying they have nobody to talk to? 20% of Americans are now saying they have nobody to talk to, not one person. Most Americans say they have an average of two confidants now, whereas in the mid-80s, the average was at least three. So the question is not just about teenagers, although I think that our responsibility is to protect the children and teenagers from things that are not good for them. For example, you know, one study from Kent State found that heavy cell phone users, they don't say to use it as a phone or texting or what, but they report higher levels of anxiety and dissatisfaction with life than the peers who use their phones less, who are getting out and doing other things.
Because so, those other things involve interacting with other people.
Yes.
That's
and,
it.
And that's right. And it involves interacting with other people. And the reverse of that, not interacting with other people, being isolated socially, this is not a badge of honor. And in fact, it disables the ability to think rationally. We are an intensely social species. And we are interacting with each other much less than we need to and than we used to, even not that long ago. And what we know from the increase in teen suicides from cyberbullying is that when they're socially isolated and when it continues from school into their home life, then it turns off their ability to think rationally.
Do you think technology, and I'm just going to pose this and you can think about it, we'll take a break after it, but when we come back, I want you to address whether technology brings folks closer or it makes them more distant. You know, I know there's a debate both ways, and I'd like to have you explore that. To my listening audience, you're tuned in to 411 Teen, a conversational forum for teens and other interested folks. This hour, I'm talking with Susan Pinker, and Susan has written a book, The Village Effect, that looks at face-to-face interaction and the importance and significance of it. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. Susan Pinker joins 411 Teen today. She is the author of The Village Effect, how face-to-face contact can make us healthier, happier, and smarter. Susan, before we went on break, I had posed the question to you that I want you to respond to and get your feelings on technology. Does it bring us closer or does it make us more distant? Or does it really just depend on the individual?
Are you ready for the answer?
Yes, ma'am.
I think, you know, the digital technology is neither good or bad. It does depend on the individual. It's all about who's using it and how they're using it. So we know, for example, that people who are extroverts and really enjoy a lot of social contact, well, they just use their digital devices to get more of that. But people who are either introverts or they might have learning disabilities or they might find it difficult to communicate with people face-to-face, they use their devices to replace face-to-face contact and become even lonelier than they were before. So it is, you're right, a question of who is using it and how, not whether it's good and bad, good or bad. So there's a phrase that social scientists use called the rich get richer and the poor get poorer that applies to using your devices, which means that those of us who are good at seeing people and empathizing with people and enjoying their company, we just make plans using our devices, and it enriches our social lives. But, for example, people who, for some reason, find it difficult to interact face-to-face, we're finding that they use their devices to supplant their real contact, and this is making them lonelier and more isolated. There's a really interesting study about children who are on the autistic spectrum who find it really difficult to communicate face-to-face, and they find it even painful sometimes to make eye contact. And what the studies are showing us is that they can make friends online and expand their social networks online, and this is a huge benefit to them. But actually, it doesn't reduce their existential loneliness, a feeling of aloneness, and that these friendships that they make online do not migrate offline. They just stay people they meet on the internet.
Exactly. Go ahead.
Sorry. So I think it's quite interesting to say, well, who is a real friend? You know, is this person going to come and hang out with you when you're having a bad day, or if you need to borrow $10 because you're in trouble.
Let's look at cyber safety. How does a parent protect and empower kids in this digital world of texting and gaming and social media? What do they do? Just how dangerous is social networking?
I'm not sure I can answer that question completely, but I will say that the important thing is helping your child make good decisions online. So not to say, well, this is a site you can go to and this is a site you can't go to, as opposed to exploring with them, for example, let's look at Facebook. What is it all about? If you're on Facebook, let's talk about it after half an hour of Facebook. How does it make you feel? Does it make you feel better or worse? Because what we know is that most kids spending time on Facebook don't feel good afterwards. They feel inadequate. They feel less socially engaged, and they feel lonelier. So I would say to parents that I would use their kids' online contact as a starting point for discussion, and also to talk about the relationship between the child or the teen and the screen and the teen and the outside world.
At what point do you think a child should be introduced to electronic devices? I know I was at a gathering just last week, and this 2-year-old was on the iPad for, I know it had to be at least 90 minutes, nonstop.
Yes.
And
well, I think there should be no device exposure to devices before the age of 2.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what the American Pediatric Society is saying, and I would echo that we should only ramp up their exposure gradually as they get older. So none at all before the age of 2, and only a little bit between the ages of 2 and 5, just a small amount, and just increase it very gradually as kids get older, to make sure that you, A, have some control over it, and B, that it doesn't replace their experiences, their playing with peers, their imaginative play, their ability to act out and solve problems through play. So gradual increasing is really the key. I think it's hard to give the number of hours because, you know, sometimes you need to be online to do your homework project, for example.
Indeed.
But that's the kind of opportunity that where parents should say, this is an opportunity for me to drift in and out of being involved in my child's life. Like, what are they doing online? Is this helping them with their homework? Is this the right site? Because as most parents know, there's a lot of garbage online too. So to help your child learn literacy online, to tell the difference between a really trustworthy site and a site that is leading them astray. These are all kind of areas that parents need to work with their kids side by side with this information. They can't just hand the child the device and say, go.
In that same framework, when does a child need a phone? Now, the youngest I have seen with a telephone, I don't know that it was a smartphone, was 5.
That's pretty young.
That's young. And this was a child that was at a playground.
A child at a playground.
Right.
Yeah, I don't actually see the necessity of children having phones before middle school or high school. And I don't understand why parents would, you know, make that expense for themselves and why they would create that area of conflict between them and their child. You know, it is one more area of their lives to monitor. You know, you have to monitor as they get into adolescence. You have to monitor how they approach alcohol. You have to monitor how they approach pornography and interacting in romantic relationships, and whether they know whether they're being taken advantage of or how to interact in a healthy way. So if you introduce the phone earlier than when you can monitor it, and discuss it, you're just creating conflict for yourself and an additional unnecessary expense.
Do you have suggestions for parents on how to address sexting with their teens?
Sexting?
Yes.
Yes. I have one word to say about it. Don't. Especially for girls, it's a very dangerous behavior and has gotten girls into very serious social situations that they can't escape. And, you know, once it starts, it can snowball extremely rapidly, and there's no way for any adult to stop it or any teenager to stop it. So certainly that's one of the conversations that you have to have around the phone. What kind of pictures can you take with this phone? What can you post on this phone? And parents should not be afraid to take it away if they think it's being used inappropriately.
Mm-hmm. Just, you're talking about...
They are paying the bills on that phone. They are the boss of that
phone.
That's
right. In your book, you talk about 15, that magic year, being the kind of watershed year. It's a year where there's a peak time for social rejection. Would you talk about that? Why do you see this at 15? What is so magical about 15?
Well, I talk about it, Liz, especially with girls.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That do. 15 is that kind of critical year for girls where they're trying to find their place in the social circles. And it is the height of bullying and exclusion among girls. And this is something that parents have to be sensitive to, depending on their child. If their child matures early, they're going to go through it at age 14. But if they're a little bit of a late bloomer, it's going to happen at 15. And there can be some pretty nasty things that are happening at school that you're going to want to be sensitive to when you come home and have dinner together. Mm-hmm. Because there could be girls who are being very mean to your daughter. And these are the kinds of issues that parents should be aware of, that there are kind of queen bees who try to push some girls out of the circle. If one girl is, say, mm-hmm. more popular with the boys, or if one girl does a little bit better in the classroom, she may be forced out of her group of friends. So it's extremely important for parents to just have their antennae raised for this and to be there. You know, mm-hmm. there is a myth among parenting that as your child gets older, they need you less and less.
No.
But as a developmental psychologist, I find it's the opposite.
Right. Indeed.
You know, that as children move through adolescence,
they need you more and more.
13 to 15, they mm-hmm. need parents around more and more.
Yeah. Well, if we talk about online, does being online set our kids up for predators to find them? Or are the real predators someone they know? Often these kids are the victims of bullying.
It's both, actually.
Okay.
So it could be, if they're online a lot, if your kid is isolated or lonely, say geographically isolated mm-hmm. and they can't move around, some lonely kids are looking for companionship online, just the way in a previous generation people looked for companionship from the television set. But it's so much more powerful online because it's interactive, electronically interactive. And there are predators online, but that's not the only place mm-hmm. there are predators. And what is most worrisome to me is not kids being contacted by strangers, but the torment that's happening at school continuing
exactly.
when they're at home.
Exactly. So, that internet is just extended, you know, from the schoolyard to the backyard.
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting that Dutch research has shown that more than a third of kids have said that they've been bullied online.
Mm-hmm.
That it's very common. But in some cases, it is people they know. So certainly keeping those real communication lines open, meaning not emailing or texting your child, but just sitting down over, you know, something hot to drink and chatting with them about how are things going lately, what is going on. That's what the family meals are for. And once again, to go back to that family meals as sort of a counterpoint to the lonely experience of sitting and facing your screen.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way to structure in time with your child. So many people have said to me about the book, one of the most frequent comments I have and complaints from parents is, I used to talk to my child when in the car when we were driving somewhere, And now my son or my daughter's face is buried in their phone the whole time, right?
Right.
And that may be true, but my concern is more, when you're in the car, you're looking at the road.
Right. Yes, you should be.
Yeah, exactly. So is when you're having a meal, what, you know, breakfast or dinner, you know, you can actually look at your child's face if they look up and make sure there's no screens at the table and actually exchange a few words for at least 20 minutes a day or even a half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
That can be the rule.
But you have to follow through on it.
Yes, I think the biggest, I guess, takeaway, Liz, from what we've been talking about is we have to have a conversation about our devices, just the way parents have to have a conversation about other areas with their teenagers, whether it's drinking or sex or how late they stay out at night. This is an area that we have to talk about, and that we must talk about, and if we don't talk about it, then we really have no legs to stand on in terms of criticizing our kids' behavior.
Right. Why are girls largely the victims of cyberbullying?
You know, I think that girls are largely the victims of bullying in any case, whether in, you know, on the computer or outside the computer. And one reason I think is that they're much more vulnerable to social influences and social forces. You know, when boys, most boys have a conflict, they'll be direct about it.
Right.
And they'll swear at their, the person
whatever.
Fighting and say, like, you know, I don't want to use bad words, but you can use your imagination.
Right.
They try to diminish somebody by hitting them, punching them, out-competing them, calling them names, whereas as girls are more likely to use covert or secret ways, manipulations of other kids in their social network to get at their enemy. And this is much more difficult to fix, and it's more difficult to detect what's going on because it happens behind the scenes.
Exactly.
And
I'm glad you mentioned
that. Girls have learned these tricks over many millennia. And so I think that's why they're more vulnerable. And they're also, many girls care more about belonging. So it's a double-edged sword. You know, I write about something in the book called The Female Effect. The female effect is how women connect more with others and create this village where they feel they belong and where they care about people and where other people care about them. But the reverse side of that is when they're adolescents and learning how to do that, there are a lot of dangerous experiments.
Exactly. What about the internet and ADHD kids? What impact, how does it affect kids with ADHD?
Well, it's interesting. It has a push-me-pull-you response in that kids with ADHD are drawn to the quick changes of the Internet. It gives them constant stimulation, and this kind of feeds a brain that's hungry for constant stimulation. So a lot of parents with kids with ADHD say, you know, he can't pay attention in the classroom, but he can pay attention to a video game, right? He doesn't have ADHD when he's playing a video game. And that is true because it gives them that quick flash, that quick reward, and lots of stimulation and lots of changes in a short span of time. But it does nothing to increase their ability to deal with frustration or to increase the length of time that they can pay attention on something.
Well, yeah.
So there's an aspect of learning and success in school that we call executive function. It's the ability to plan, to control our impulses, and to wait for a reward, to plan our way through problem solving. And really, the Internet does not help ADHD kids with those skills.
No. In the last 50 seconds, why is the Internet so addictive?
Well, Liz, this, we are a social species, and the Internet gives us a quick hit of novel and short contact. So, like junk food, it gives us what we want in the short term, but it doesn't satisfy our deep human needs in the long term.
Susan, that's it. I want to say thank you. I really appreciate you sharing your expertise with us. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.